WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We're concluding our end-of-the-decade series of interviews from the archives with a comedy show. Along with Eddie Murphy, Spike Lee, and Keenan Ivory Wayans, Robert Townsend is one of the black filmmakers who emerged in the 80s. And like Murphy and Wayans, Townsend got his start doing stand-up. Townsend directed Eddie Murphy's film Raw, and in 1987, Townsend produced, directed, and starred in the comedy Hollywood Shuffle. It's a semi-autobiographical movie about a young black actor who learns that the only parts available to him are black stereotypes.
Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies.
Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting.
Sure. Okay. Let me see. I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?
Thank you.
You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I could do it in iambic.
You be messing with the wrong dude, bro.
Thank you.
Did you like it?
Very much.
I be got no weapon.
When I spoke with Robert Townsend in 1987, his memories of auditioning for the stock black male roles as pimps and junkies were still very fresh.
I didn't know how to speak up at that point because every actor in town was in there auditioning, and I said, wait, this is a terrible script. Maybe it's me. And then I started thinking about it, and I would go in and read a script, and I go, this is terrible. And then the next guy, this is the greatest pimp I've ever read, you know. And I think it had to do with, you know, I began back then to begin to look and see something was wrong.
What kind of roles were you auditioning for that you're talking about?
Stoolies on TV shows, you know, the guys that always have the information that the cops always talk to, Huggy Bear, Turkey Neck, you know, they always have those weird names. So those are the kind of parts I would audition for.
Are you convincing in that kind of role?
I'm a good actor. I could pull it off. Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a good actor. You know, I wouldn't mind doing a street character if I could play a lawyer next week and a doctor the week after that, or a detective like Sam Ace or something like that.
But the problem is there aren't many roles like that to play.
Right. They always write the stereotypical, you know, just jive street.
The character in your movie is directed to be blacker while he's playing a part or auditioning for a part. Were you ever directed to be more black?
Oh, yeah, because, see, the way I talk, when you're considered black, you're supposed to talk like, well, yeah, baby, you know, I'm doing this interview and things with you. So that's the way I should talk. That's considered black. If I was saying, like, oh, this is national radio, baby, that's black. But the way I'm talking now, then they say, well, you don't sound black. I mean, you could, you know, if I was just tuning in, I would say, is this a black person? I don't give you the key words. And so a lot of times they ask you to be blacker because black is, you know, all the, you know, sitcoms of the 70s, and they said, say what? So that's considered black.
You had a lot of actors who you cast in your movie. Did they all have stories similar to yours about being cast in roles they didn't really want in the first place, roles that were very stereotypical?
Yeah, I mean, everybody, I think one of the reasons the actors agreed to do the film was because they could identify with the movie. It was their story. A lot of actors, older actors, black actors, come up to me now and they say, thank you for telling our story and what we were all going through and is going on now, and, you know, you told.
Now, you've also been in some TV commercials. For years, there were virtually no black actors in TV commercials, but now, especially in burger commercials and in soft drink commercials, there's a lot of black actors in it. Are there new stereotypes of blacks coming out through these commercials?
No, I think commercials, if anything, they show black people in a better light. I mean, in TV commercials, at least I had dignity in 60 seconds. I mean, I was a bank teller, I was a construction worker, I was a plumber, just a regular guy hanging out at an office building, you know, waiting on a date. I mean, they have different, you know, commercials at least show life. You'll see a black family on a TV commercial. On TV shows, you never see that. You know, you'll see, like, for McDonald's, you'll see, it's time to go. Our family's on her way to McDonald's. Hey, Dad, you know, and they'll show like a Loving Family or Tide commercial. They, you know, show a family with a mother and father. Your average show on TV, it's always, I had to raise these kids on my own and I'd never seen they daddy.
What are some of the movies you liked when you were growing up?
Wizard of Oz. My favorite film of all time is Here Comes Mr. Jordan with Robert Montgomery. That was one of my favorite films.
I love that film. That's the film about the boxer who's been reincarnated, basically, sent back down
right.
to Earth.
Yeah, Claude Rains, Robert Montgomery, and Warren Beatty did the updated version with Buck Henry and James Mason. It's like, Joe, listen, Joe, you're not Pendleton, Joe. You can't stay in this body, Joe. You know, that was one of my favorite films.
As a teenager, did you like any of the exploitation films like Shaft and Superfly?
I love those movies because that was the first time we saw the black man get the girl. You know, I remember seeing the scene in Superfly when he made love in the bathtub, and it was like, I can't believe this. Because other than that, black people had played butlers, and it's like, you want your luggage, Mr. Jenkins? And that was the only role we played. And so when you saw Shaft, and he had a gun, and he slapped people around, and he fought for right, you know, it was like, great. We had never seen it. Because normally, the black actor was the buddy to the star. He never, you know, like, he never was the man. You know, he never was in charge and said, I'm fighting for right. And that's what I'm going to do here. You guys are bad, you know. And Shaft was that way, and Superfly was that way. I just think that they made more pimp movies than they made movies about, you know, black people from the regular walks of life. I think that's what messed everything up. There were too many negative role models. I mean, if they would have had a pimp movie and then a movie about a doctor, then a movie about a lawyer, and a movie about a guy who was in love, everything would have been fine. But it was just, you know, 90 pimp movies versus one sounder. You know, that was what the deal was.
You started as a comic, I think, before you became an actor. And you do great impressions. Did you do impressions a lot as a kid? Did you do impressions of teachers or movie stars, family?
Yeah, I did a lot of impressions. I used to cheat the phone company. I used to call because I didn't have money. And when I was, you know, going to the basketball court, I would call the fellas, and that's how I used my talents back then. I'd get on the phone and, hello, operator, I'm sorry, I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't reach this number. Yes, operator, my name is Dr. John Wilson. Yes, thank you for putting me through, operator. Thank you. Yo, Willie, how you doing, man? Yeah, meet me at the gym, 4:30. So I would do different voices and characters.
Why did you go into acting from being a comic?
Well, I wanted to be an actor first. I wanted to be a dramatic actor, and everybody would laugh at me. So I said, I should be a comedian.
Did they really laugh at you?
They really did. I would do a dramatic scene, and people would laugh. And I was going, wait a minute, that was dramatic. That was drama. And people would go, no, you're funny, man. You're funny. No, that's funny. You know, and I said, let me be a comedian then.
Richard Belzer has often been called a comics comic. In the early days of Saturday Night Live, he warmed up the audiences before the broadcast started. Then he graduated to appearing on the show as a guest. In the 80s, he was a regular on Alan Thicke's short-lived late-night show. He had his own cable specials and headlined at clubs from coast to coast. I spoke with him 2 years ago. He told me he was thrown out of every school he attended, then kicked out of the Army, too.
I was actually discharged under honorable conditions for being too funny to carry a gun. So wait a minute, this guy's too funny. He's too funny, which is almost true. Actually, I got out of the Army by feigning mental illness, if you will. I pretended that I was suicidal, and I staged this whole thing where I said I got beat up and my back was hurting, and they found out I was faking, and they sent me to the Jewish chaplain in the Army. I didn't know there were Jewish chaplains. I thought Pat O'Brien was the... I didn't know Jews joined the Army. I didn't know Jews were, let alone chaplains. And I went to this rabbi, and I said, Rabbi, because my sergeant said that you know, you got to go see your chaplain, Belzer, because you need help. So I went to the chaplain. I said, Chaplain, with all due respect, I think I need to see a psychiatrist. And he said, you know, Freud was a Jew, and the reason he became a psychiatrist was to discover his Jewishness. You don't need a psychiatrist. You need to discover why you're a Jew. And he lectured me on kosher food and choirs. And how I could sing in the Army Jewish choir and eat kosher food. And I said, really, Rabbi, I need to see a psychiatrist. He said, you have to discuss. Do you have a girlfriend? I said, no. He said, did you ever have? I said, yeah. Was she Jewish? Good. Like, everything was revolved around Judaism, which was the farthest thing from my mind. And I just wanted to get out of the Army. Finally, I was allowed to go to the psychiatrist, and I having had a little college, I knew every freshman psychology phobia. So I said that I wet the bed, I was suicidal, I hated my mother, I was afraid of women. I just did every cliche in psychology, and I got out.
That's amazing.
I hope no one's listening.
That's probably
from
one
the Pentagon.
One of your most convincing performances.
Yeah, and I never do this on stage. Maybe I should tell them my Army story on stage.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. And so there's a lot more. I mean, it's a 40-minute story. I'm really brutally paraphrasing the story.
Well, let me ask you about your life and how you got into comedy. Now, I know you grew up in a housing project.
Yes.
And I've read that you didn't have a lot of money when you were growing up.
No.
And I assume that you were one of the funny kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Was that a kind of protective shield for you, being funny? Did that mean that you weren't going to be picked on by the toughest kids around?
Well, it's interesting. My wit has saved me more than once. And I found when I was a kid that a lot of the tough guys in the school liked my wit. So I would hang around with some tough guys, and we would come across some other people, and I would, like, put them down, and they'd go to beat me up, and my friends would beat them up. So I never really had to get in any fights, really, because I would, like, kind of instigate a fight, and then Vinny or Rocco or Vito would do the rest.
Instigate through verbal
yeah.
abuse?
I sound like a little fascist, don't I?
Yes, you do.
But that's when I was a little, you know, I was young. It was 30 years ago. I was a young, skinny kid.
Now, you've said in one of your routines that when you were young, your mother used to beat you and that you would try to tell her jokes to get her to stop.
Right, right. Well, she was the toughest audience I ever had.
Yeah.
And my kitchen was the toughest room I ever worked.
Well, how true is that, though?
It's quite literally true. It didn't work as much as legend has it. But I when I was a kid, I had a crew cut, or a zip, what they called then, very short hair, and I looked just like Jerry Lewis. And I used to do a Jerry Lewis impression. And sometimes my mother would get mad at me, and I'd do my Jerry Lewis shtick, and she'd laugh and forget to hit me. But I'd say that worked maybe 2 times out of 20. So she usually wound up hitting me anyway.
I think the very first time I saw you perform was on Saturday Night Live, and you were doing your impression of Bob Dylan in, like, a retirement center, singing in a Yiddish accent.
Right, well, the 86-year-old Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Now, I hate to ask questions like,
sure,
how did that idea come to you? But really, how did that idea come to you?
Well, when I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, and we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav. And then he gets older, you know. Oi, once upon a time, you dressed so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shediver Dal, you're bound to fall, you thought they was all kidding you. And so on.
Oh, who spoke Yiddish in your family?
Actually, I just got back into Yiddish music. I've discovered these things. Everyone in my family spoke Yiddish, but I resent the fact that they didn't teach me. They didn't teach my brother or my cousins. My parents would talk in Yiddish. My grandparents would talk in Yiddish. And there's a comedian who does a routine. I can't think of who it is, but where it's true, if I may borrow the routine without crediting the person. And that is that Jewish families had the habit, the adults would tell a joke. They'd be telling a joke in English, and then a kid would walk in the room, and then they do the punchline in Yiddish. They say, so the guy walks up to the maid, he opens the door, he sees that she has no clothes on, and then a kid walks in the room, and he goes, "Achal v'shin v'chel v'cha," and you don't know what the punch... It was the most frustrating thing I've ever... I still resent my uncles to this day for doing that to me. And I wish I could remember the comedian that did that. Maybe it was Robert Klein, but that's not my routine, but it's a true story.
You know, since it was the older people in your family who spoke Yiddish, did you think that when you grew up, you'd automatically know the language?
That's funny, because I have a theory that everyone, when they get old, no matter what religion they are, they have a Jewish accent. Even Irish people, they get to be past 65. I want to go to the store now, because I'm in the store, good, because I can't, hello? You know, everyone, Italians, everybody, they, for some reason, they get a Jewish accent. Don't ask me why.
Oh, gosh. One of the problems nowadays is that special interests are so fragmented, and there's only a fairly narrow number of things that everybody knows in common, like the records everybody knows or the books everybody's read. Do you ever want to say something in one of your routines that you know you can't say because only like three people are going to get the joke?
Well, that's one of my jobs. I like to talk about esoteric things. I mean, not 90% of my act, but there are a lot of things in my act over the years that have been things that I've seen or read that is not open to the general public, or literary references, or things about science, or things about all different kinds of subjects that I feel compelled to talk about. And without being patronizing, sometimes I think I can educate the audience. And if I mention something that they never heard of, a literary reference or a line from a play or a new scientific discovery, then maybe they'll go and find out about it. So I'm not inhibited. I know a lot of comedians try to be as broad-based and as commercial and as accessible as possible, and as least offensive as they can be. And for good or ill, I never subscribe to that theory.
I know that in 84, I think it was, you were diagnosed as having cancer, and you're over that.
I was?
Through surgery.
Oh, oh my God.
You said in a magazine article that in a way that was a blessing in disguise. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that when you feel the breeze from the wings of death, as I did, the more you feel how mortal you are. I mean, all the near-death cliches are true. It does change your life. You do look at things differently. You do value people and events more, and I don't mean to be corny, but it's very true. And I think that I reordered my life as a result of that situation. And I mean, I don't recommend you go out and get cancer by any stretch of the imagination, but it's certainly not a totally negative situation. I mean, I was it's kind of hard to talk about. I mean, I was devastated by it, but it was also a very revelatory epiphany for me, if I may be Joycean for a second.
Do you think it changed your work as a comedian at all?
People say it has, but I feel I still have the same point of view. I have a very cynical point of view in terms of the world situation, and I think that comes through. I may seem less bitter now on stage, which is, I guess, in quotes, more commercial. But I'll let other people theorize about that.
Are you in stand-up for the long haul, or would you eventually like to get out of it and just go into acting?
You know, James Cagney, somebody once asked James Cagney what he would like to be remembered as, and he said a hoofer, because he was a dancer, and obviously he's one of the greatest actors in the history of film. I like to be remembered as a stand-up comic, or thought of as a stand-up comic, even though I'm very interested in acting in films and doing radio and records and some music things, but I'm basically a stand-up comedian and proud of it.
Comic Richard Belzer.